He said that, you know, just a year and a half, 2 years ago. And he said, fuck, I should have met him. I should have talked to him. And that's the point. Everybody, all these idiots out there who are the gurus, but they're now getting toppled by the women, the Elena Lamberti, the Jack, Janine Marchessault, Judith Stamp, and Judith Fitzgerald. They write, as Bipple says, the best books on McLuhan are by women. They all fucking study Don Thiel. They, for some reason, they come later, and they read Don Thiel's books, and they get the basic message that makes their book better than Logan's and Kirchhoff's stuff. So that's the key. Anyways, even a lot more. I can make a great case about how Don Thiel was the genius that McLuhan never mentioned. And Don went on to do all kinds of things. His books are the best books to counter the disservice of McLuhan, blah, blah, blah. So there it is. You guys now know. And Susanna represents the crowd, the peanut gallery, going, what? Don Thiel? Now, Susanna doesn't know anything about Don Thiel, but she's heard the bad mouthing of him or something. So, very interesting, eh?
I think it's amazing. I think that's really amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing that it's a trick answer, or it's amazing that Don, you're appreciating Don, or you didn't know this?
No, I'm just appreciating Don. I think it's incredible. And I think clearly he was being denied because there was jealousy there.
Yeah. And there's a lot of letters, and all, I've got correspondence between them. It's a big story.
Yeah.
So did you know anything about Thiel before tonight, Reiner?
Well, you spoke about Thiel many times to me in the past.
All right, yeah. So you think it's amazing. Well, then that, could you have guessed the answer if you'd known the
question? No.
Okay, so what is it that's amazing? My genius in picking him as the answer? Is that what you're complimenting?
Yeah, pretty much, because I wouldn't know.
Never thought of him.
I don't know shit, but at the same time, Don Thiel makes sense in light of what you're saying, especially by not being mentioned, because needless to say, if he was mentioned, there would be more jealousy and more, you know, vehement behavior being thrown back at McLuhan, and Eric would probably be the first.
Go ahead. Eric would probably be the first.
The first one to slander Don Thiel.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got a lot of different stories to supplement this, but one thing is McLuhan could never get his program acknowledged as part of a PhD program or course credits, the media ecology program from the university. But Don Thiel goes to McGill and does it first. And there's a letter in the letters of Marshall McLuhan where he's writing to Don. To President Bissell, Claude Bissell, who's his old friend, he says, "What the hell? There's a guy in Montreal that's got a program, and I fucking started all this shit, and you guys won't give me one. You won't give me the PhD credits or whatever the language is. You know, get it acknowledged, of course." He's talking about Don Thiel, but he won't say his name in his letter, a personal private letter to Bissell. Bissell was a good friend of Don Thiel's. He knew who he was talking about, but he wouldn't even say it. So there's a good sample of a guy that's never going to be mentioned.
He who shall not be named.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What'd you say, Reiner?
He who shall not be named.
And,
so
and
Bob,
I once and now here's another thing. Don Thiel, he talked to James Joyce of the Evergreens. Don did it all. So one day he asked me, Bob, what – you know, this is a very smart guy, and he humbly says, Bob, what quadrant am I in on your chart? I said, and I smiled, he finally been asked, I said, you're in my quadrant, Don. Which, what does that mean? That means, you know, he's subsumed by me, but he was quiet, and he said, oh, okay. But it's totally right that he is in my quadrant. He's the expert on James Joyce. And he, and that's my symbol in my quadrant. And I am the new Don Thiel. I'm the guy that they won't fucking mention.
That's what I was just going to say, Bob. I was going to say Don Thiel is, they treated him like they're treating you now.
Yep. Every one of them will die. And they're looking for the guff, and they go, where's Bob? Where's Bob? I need Bob. And we'll be back here, party, living it up. And all those fuckers who wouldn't talk to me back then will die. And they will not know. They will be frustrated. Like the TV show Stranger Things, which I'm not watching, but I heard about. So, and I would even add Joan, Carolyn. I'd say Don and Joan. Because Joan did everything with Don, and, you know, she always got credits in his articles, a lot of them. You know what they did? They pissed off Stephen Joyce, because back in the early 90s, when the Internet started, they put all of Finnegan's Wake online. And that was, and nobody could do that. But Canadian law allowed Canadians to do it. And that pissed off Joyce's grandson, Stephen Joyce, very mad about that. Until it was released, the estate got released of all rules a few years ago. But, you know, 20 years ago, Don was such a sub-genius, he said, fuck Stephen Joyce, he can't get to me. I'm going to put it online. And he did. And all the Joyce scholars appreciated that. So, it's a great story. Okay, so.
Yeah, we got such a... what do you call it, Bob? A head start here, or we just?
Yeah, I gave you guys a preview of what's coming next week.
I know we get the best McLuhan here.
Right? Because Mark's on there. Well, it could be Saint Aquinas, but no, I think it's Saint Bonaventure, and he's saying he has to be medieval, but he's naming people that Marshall wrote about. So he's so into his Catholic Thomas, he's determined to say that McLuhan is basically a medieval character. I say no, Marshall's Paleolithic. Caveman stuff, but he can't see that because he wants to fit McLuhan into his Catholic scenario. So, what? You watch this, man. I could be kicked off the group when I named Don Thiel because they're going to think I'm not serious, that it was a joke, but I'm not. I am serious, really, about Don Thiel, what he knew. Okay, so let's stop.
Yeah,
there.
You've talked a lot about Thiel. You've reviewed Thiel's work and. Yep. Maybe shared letters.
And these women, like Lamberti, they get their, they make extra good McLuhan books because they study Thiel. And I'm reading this present book called Digital Modernism, which one reads after Elena's book. It's incredible. And it totally supports, is academic support for my chart. I now have, what my chart's about is being written by this Yale person, Jessica Preston.
Really?
Yeah. It's called Digital Modernism. See, the digital is considered postmodern. So you're like saying, you know, what would that be? You know, St. Thomas Aquinas was a devout atheist, a religious atheist. It's a contradiction to say digital modernism. But she lays out the case, which is presented in my chart. Literally, it's what's in my chart. And well worth understanding. But you got to read Lamberti's book first. And Lamberti's influenced by Thiel. And this Jessica Pressman is influenced by Thiel. They're the ones that found Thiel because they didn't know any better because they're Generation X or millennials, you know. They don't. They just go with what's available at the time 10 years ago when they started writing their books. And Thiel was out there and was available. So they innocently read him, whereas Logan, de Kirchhoff, and the rest of them didn't. So they did lousy books. And like Paul Levinson. And... in that, did you see the other article, which I did post? No, it was done on New Explorations Group. The TV Guide article? Did you see that one? Just two little pages?
No, I missed that
Check
one.
It.
No.
Yeah, that's last night. That's before the big one, the Joyce one. And the last line is an argument against Neil Postman, which the Lance Strait and the New York Media Call Association make. They're more into Postman than McLuhan, and they become stupid. Like, Jerry Fialka went to their last conference last summer, and he said to me, or he said to someone who told, passed on to me, that they're all just old fuddy-duddy Neil Postmanites. So he noticed that. But here's a rebuttal to Neil Postman, the last line in this little TV Guide article, written 8 years before Postman did his book called Amusing Yourselves to Death. So we even got a Postman thing in there. But that's because Peter Breckman, he's the one who seems to be under Mark's influence, I posted my two-hour dialogue with Don as we edited his book, The Virtual McLuhan. And Peter, I posted, and the next day Peter came on and said, well, could you give me this article, that article? I said, no. No, I didn't say anything. And I waited, and he kept persisting. I said, okay, I will post something if you comment on the audio of the Thiel dialogue, which you haven't even acknowledged. So about 5 hours later, he posts, this is fucking amazing, Bob. This is incredible. Oh, my God, blah, blah. He goes on about, you know, listening to the Thiel thing. But he says, you mentioned where McLuhan, you said to Don that he said Lucifer was the patron saint of engineers. I got to have that. Where is that? He says, you said it was a Roy Shields TV Guide interview. So I looked up my Roy Shields thing, which is about 1977, and it didn't have it. But I found this other one, which was a column by McLuhan, not an interview by somebody. It was him writing in 78 on issues of 1978, partly Quebec separatism. And that was where he said Lucifer, patron saint of engineers. So it was a good prompt he asked me, and then I found some stuff. So he'll see that. Interesting. But they have to do their homework before I'm going to give them what they want now. They want stuff on Duns Scotus and other stuff that I claimed. They give us the documents. Like Mark Stallman once, he's fixated on the Great Books Program in 1946, where Robert Hutchins at the University of Chicago, who becomes a great Trilateral Commission establishment guy, like a god in the Pharaoh world, he has a big argument with McLuhan over the Great Books Program. So Mark has some crazy Catholic angle on it, and I said, no, I got correspondence between them. You're wrong. So he says, well, show me the stuff. Give me the cut. They want me to dump my files onto these ingrates who will not get it, understand it anyway, so I'm holding back the good stuff because they don't appreciate it. I mean, they don't know how to get the information from it. They're just going to distort it. So I got a lot of other stuff to give them that will frustrate them. I am on there. So Mark says, no. So Peter came on the other day before he got smart, and he says, what the fuck are you on here for? What is your target? What's your goal? Why are you here bugging us little University of Toronto students? And I said, Carol and I started a revolution in Toronto in 1984. I said a revolution / transformation. And you guys need to be updated. So we're back here to you U of T Toronto people, and we're here to update the revolution transformation in Ontario and all of Canada. And so there, the little window I have, because I can't get on any place to tell those people in Canada. You know, Alex Kuskus got on his blog, he's allowed, he's a Canadian, they got a lot of Canadians on there. I would like to tell the whole Ion McLuhan story. I'm not allowed on there to mention Ion. But this stupid little place, I can fucking put the latest good stuff out to five unappreciative people, plus Bert. And I encounter Bert to like everything I post. Lucius Kratos. I like that. They're going to notice that eventually. Bert, you're some kind of fucking robot or a bot. No matter what I post.
Right.
Yeah, Bert likes it. Chad came in. Chad, I got as many of you guys in there. They need backup.
Got it, Bob.
But hey, Reiner, you should join New Explorations Group. It's I'm making it very interesting.
Yeah,
you're just getting their attention.
What, Gene?
You're just getting their attention with your question and the answer, Thiel, before you blast them with Ion. Is this what I'm hearing?
Right. Well, I've been saying Ion stuff. I posted.
Okay.
That really ignited Mark. Like, Mark, he liked the Evergreens. He didn't miss on public. He did an Evergreen session with me, and they were good. And that was in 2001, 2002. But he had one session with Ion. His girlfriend told him it's fucking not real. And so I guess he went with that. And so he told me Ion's ridiculous. He likes Evergreens, but not Ion. So he said the other day, Ion's pretty, Evergreens are pretty good, but when Bob started talking to Ion, that Ion is absolutely bonkers. So he reached his mental limits there with Ion. I mean, wait till he hears, if he ever heard any stuff. So I'm posting as much as possible on there and get the other kids that are his understudies to hear Ion, and they're gonna force Mark to have to deal with Ion if they fall for Ion.
And they will.
Not yet, Reiner. They're devout Catholics. Okay. They They have already. That's Reiner's prophecy. They will. And I told them, I said, you guys aren't going to understand this now, but you will be begging me in a few years down the road for access to buy stuff, because you'll all be dying otherwise, because the frequency will have changed. So I say stuff on there that I say on the radio show, and I would say on Alex Kuss's thing in front of the 1,500 McLuhan professors, but I'll just get kicked off. But Mark has created a place where I can actually mouth off and say what I fully want to say.
Well, if they're devout Catholics and they hear, you know, just a little bit of the ion stuff, they're going to think that you're the devil incarnate.
And they've already said it. They've already said it. You have to go. Maybe Bert found them. Adam Pugin, whatever his last name is, he started saying, this is demon stuff, Bob.
This is bad.
What?
You got them scared. They're going to run away screaming.
Yeah. I'm going to ruin their little group.
Mark didn't help because he said Bob talks to dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that probably scared Bob.
Yeah, but he's laying out a big part of my history and things I did with him to alienate them. You know, he said, well, look, Bob's Church of Subgenius, he posted the Subgenius book. This is Bob thinks that he's the head of this crazy cult. He's saying, quote, the facts and using it. That's the battle going on. And I have to ignore that and keep posting my stuff. So we'll see who runs out first.
Well,
but
we
you
know
give resources, Bob. Mark Stallman just pontificates. He just pontificates.
That's right.
Not giving
and it's
resources.
True. He gets kicked off every forum. I used to let anybody in, but I banned Mark because we'd get all this distracting bullshit if we let him in. So even Dobstown banned him, but he's banned from everywhere. And so we're in his one little group that he has going, and he's got these young kids believing his stuff. Okay. We got to go to the book, Carolyn. You're well nourished, Carolyn. You're ready to go? No, we'll do they heard a good chunk of it. We'll do the rest later, and they can hear it later. I mean, I got another 2 hours to play of Ion, which we'll do later, but it's going to be really good. So I don't think any of you will be up for it, but you'll hear it in the archives.
Okay, you got the book in front of you?
Yes, and I think we'll mute people so we don't get interrupted. You've said all your bits, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's hear Carolyn's loves this book.
All participants are now muted.
Okay, we're starting with our next installment of reviewing Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic by Elena Lamberti.
Well, keep talking for a second because I have to get on to Amazon to download.
Okay, well, I'll go back to the group. And they can talk.
All participants are now unmuted.
I'm interested in, Bert, what ideas do you get on the Dobbs-Stallman debate? Well, you said he was dogmatic or pontificates, right? Hey, I unmuted you guys.
I'm here, but I couldn't answer that.
Yeah, he's just pontificating. He's not really. I enjoyed his little confrontation with Alex before he quit.
Yes. Remember, Mark. He was LaRouche's bodyguard. There's a lot of LaRouche style name calling in his style, and I just skim his emails. I've got, 50 of them from 10 years ago when we were on other places. He's still saying the same thing that he always said.
Yeah.
But he's added a new twist, which is that McLuhan never understood memory or imagination, and that the digital technology extends memory and imagination, whereas the electric phase extended the senses. So he's saying McLuhan missed the internal senses. And you look up Thomas Aquinas, he said there were four internal senses. So I have to show to Mark that, no, it's included, even in the phrase in the interior landscape. But that's his new thing. So he's teaching these kids that McLuhan's obsolete, and you can make a case that McLuhan's obsolete, but he has formed something called the Center for Digital Life, and he's trying to claim his big discovery about memory and imagination. And he made in one of the posts, he said, you know, Bob, when we were talking back in 2008, 2009, you were talking about the Android meme and all that, and you wouldn't listen. And I was thinking about this memory and all the stuff I'm saying now. I was thinking back then, but I didn't say it to anybody, and you were too arrogant or just mouth off about yourself to notice that I had something to tell you. So he's claiming that it goes back that far. Let's see. So the way he describes the digital environment is so different from the electric, and that Trump rode in on the digital environment and beat the electric environment, which was television. He's describing the way I define the Android meme. So it's a bit limited, but it's approximately about what the Android meme is, the digital phase. But he's not going to accept my position for the Center for Ionic Life, is that ion is the next environment after the digital. So he's living, promoting the digital as where we're at today and why people don't understand Trump or anything, because they're living still in the rearview mirror of the electrical television era. So that's the debate, Bert, if you haven't figured it out. That's what's going on here. The digital versus
ion. You just reminded me, Bob, the last part of Don Thiel's Beyond the Word. He talked about memory. He referred to memory as the art of memory.
Right. No, it's all in Don Thiel. And Mark, he can't read Thiel. He doesn't read Joyce and those guys. He said that's all stupid stuff because he's more of a semi-scientist and theologian orientation. So that's exactly – that's why I'm saying Don Thiel, which is a dig at Mark.
Yes.
Don talks about the very issues for the digital era that Mark is saying that no one understands, only he does. And he already said last week that Don Thiel certainly didn't understand him. But, yeah, that's right. It's in Beyond the Word.
Yes.
That's good you noticed that. Okay, so now we can start.
Great book.
What?
Beyond the Word is a great book. I'm going to go back and reread it.
Yeah, you and see, it's good you're on there because you can read what Mark's saying and apply it to Thiel, you know, because he's going to go on about this. Okay, I'm going to mute everybody. Carolyn's ready.
All participants are now muted.
Okay, great. Milsher McLuhan's Mosaic, Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies, Elena Lamberti, and still loving the book. Elena is a great professor, a great teacher. She lays out McLuhan so well with appropriate quotes and kind of definitions and her own expertise. So still loving it. We left off around page 14, Bob. So go to 14 and the header, Pointing to Action, : this book.
Yeah, yes.
So I wanted to talk about McLuhan's poetics. I just started to hear about poetics with Thiel. I didn't know people were talking about McLuhan's poetics.
When did you hear that about Thiel?
Just, you know, probably in your many conversations where I'd listen in. Over the years.
Yes, that's what Thiel's expert on, is showing McLuhan is a major poetic guy.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, after Gert Stern, who's a well-known beatnik poet, after he met Don Thiel, I introduced him on City Island back in 2005, he then read Don Thiel's book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, and he said, I never knew Don was a poet. I thought he was just a literary critic. But no, he said, I never knew McLuhan was a poet.
Mm.
He got from Don that McLuhan was a poet, and Gerd, who knew McLuhan, corresponded with him, was a friend, never thought of McLuhan as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the revolutionary part of Don's updating what poetry is. in his books, how it has to deal with the new multimedia situation, which is what Lamberti is doing, trying to say, no, there's a new kind of poetics that we got to teach that McLuhan was a figure for.
Yeah, it's like saying poetry is a mosaic. It's not going to be just a bunch of facts. It's going to be interweaving.
It's not going to be limited to the book.
Mm.
It's going to include newer media.
So we don't have to go into it much, but she quotes Umberto Eco's definition of poetics as an operative project that pervades a specific work and that leads to a given form, at once original and traditional, that is linked to other pre-existing forms. So that just kind of says what we just said.
Yeah.
And the next one is just the next paragraph. Whereas his operative project is well known.
Whose?
McLuhan's, sorry.
Let me see.
Maybe
that.
I'll go back. Just continuing on, moving forward from this definition, I argue, Elena says, that Marshall McLuhan's poetics is far more complex than normally recognized, especially as far as form is concerned. Whereas his operative project is well known, dash, to investigate the impact of new media on human consciousness and environment so as to force the reveal and eventually counterbalance the related side effects, the form which shapes and gives new functional potential to such a project is still underestimated.
Yeah, the form of how Marshall wrote about it, mm-hmm. the issue of media ecology, how he presented the question of this new field that he founded, is really more important than the field.
Or she's talking about form and content here, I guess. That's...
Yeah, and the content of McLuhan. Oh, he's a guy who likes TV.
Yeah.
And then you read a little bit more. Oh, he wants to bounce off TV or do something with it, change the lines on it, cut down on its effects.
Right.
That's McLuhan's modern message or postmodern message. But the way he communicates it, Elena says, is more important than his particular media ecology message.
Right.
And that, she calls that formal analysis.
Right.
Which comes from the new critics of England, Richards and Leavis. They were known as bringing in formal analysis or formalist criticism.
Hmm. Okay, next paragraph. Literature and the arts, in fact, constitute a sort of constant fil rouge, which French, which means a constantly unspooling thread connecting in time McLuhan's media explorations. Mosaic or field approach is the term McLuhan himself employed to define these explorations. Mosaic was also his way of rendering them. So just more kind of confirmation of what's going on.
Yeah, and then she goes, that is McLuhan's writing technique.
Mm.
In the following chapters, because this is an introductory chapter, both these terms will be questioned and explored. And then she quotes Don Thiel.
Yeah.
So you want to read that part?
As Donald F. Thiel clearly acknowledged in his last book on McLuhan, quote, what remains relatively unlearned from that figure, bracket, McLuhan's image as a media guru or as a pop icon, bracket, with its strengths and weaknesses as a pop poet, bridging modernism and postmodernism, is the vital importance of the arts and literature and their history to the understanding of technology, culture, communication, artifacts, and the processes of human perception.
Which is her agenda, to relate this new media aphoristic public performance by McLuhan comes from the modernist arts and literatures of the first part of the 20th century, which is Don Thiel's theme also.
Mm-hmm. So she just elaborates a bit more on that, and then I'm going to another paragraph and a half down.
The one begins in part two?
Just, yeah, four lines into that. The four different masks that we put on McLuhan, the media oracle, media guru, the modernist, the media techno fan. This investigation, her book, cross-reads McLuhan's passion for the faculties in the light of his boundless intellectual curiosity, which embraced literature, arts, anthropology, philosophy, and the hard sciences and social sciences alike. So he was one of the first people I heard who wanted to bring all the different professions together.
Yep.
He really did not like the specialists.
Well, the explorations group in the 50s was known to be one of the first interdisciplinary groups. But here the CIA was already doing that. And they would gather professors from all fields and then work on some problem. So, and I have a something, I think Tate Carpenter writes in his appendix to Don's Virtual McLuhan book about how he and McLuhan went to some of these early 50s conferences, ostensibly as anthropologists. And Ted told me personally in the mid-90s, that's when he realized the CIA was running the show because there was a whole other agenda going on at these conferences that he and Marshall objected to and probably stimulated them, because that was in 52, to create their own journal and provide an anti-environment to what the CIA was trying to do with interdisciplinary studies. So a year later, they start the journal.
I think we might have already gone through this, but it's okay.
I can't find the media, your sentence. That's the paragraph that begins part two?
In part two, yeah, yeah.
How far down does he make?
8-10 lines.
It's all about Ezra Pound, the better craftsman. I didn't hear you say that.
In part one.
Yeah, I'm saying part two. Okay, so in part one. I did that.
Yeah, we've done that. And then we, the next page, it talks about McLuhan using ancient grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic as the basis of his exploration. So we did that. And then just, are you there? Just below that.
You have to give me the paragraph words.
Page 15, toward the end of the page.
No, you have to tell me what paragraph you're in and what the first words of the paragraph is.
Right, it's still in part one. It's a long paragraph.
Yeah, okay. So she says, I will examine how the mosaic is conceived, that sentence. Oh, no, I see. Ancient grammar and rhetoric and are the basis. Now, that's the trivium.
Yeah.
The quadrivial part of McLuhan is what they miss. And the quadrivial is a hidden ground of McLuhan. The later phases of the early McLuhan is he starts being quadrivial. And the POBs, print-oriented bastards, they still go back to his PhD and just deal with the trivium. They don't get to the quadrivial.
Right.
And Baudrillard in the 90s was one of the first to kind of acknowledge it. He said, I regard McLuhan as a musician. and music is one of the four arts of the quadrivium.
Okay. And just below that, I don't know, did we go into her saying, I will examine how the mosaic is conceived as an original verbal, vocal, visual form of writing? That is acoustic and not linear, as once involving the human sensorium, not simply as a visual experience, but as a tactile or participatory process.
Yep, that's an accurate statement. The verbi vocal visual indicates multisensory aspects. So it's.
And you asked her about why she used verbo instead of verbi.
Yeah, and she had a, this was on the Facebook page after I first complimented her, she had a whole grammatical, etymological, explaining how in Italian, which is what she is, verbo is the way they do verbi. And it had a broader meaning. So she did make the mistake. It was a consciously done strategy.
Right. And then we go into part two, and this is all familiar about how she brings in four main modernist writers to describe McLuhan's roots, the Ford, Maddox Ford, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and Wyndham Lewis. And I remember you waxing poetic about those guys, so I don't think we have to repeat that.
All right, so what we've done so far is stuff that you kind of know, so what do you why are you highlighting this?
We talked about it last week, so I'm just skimming over it.
Okay, and the thing is that you like that this is how she introduces McLuhan.
Right, right. And she gives a nice little overview of these four writers and how they help, supposedly, she thinks, how they help influence McLuhan. But she doesn't put in, what doesn't she put in here? Eliot.
Yeah.
So hopefully people will get the book themselves and read it. So let's jump ahead to page 16. She doesn't really break up her paragraphs. It's hard to tell you where to go. But at the top, the paragraph starts with "What an amazing sentence!" And remember, maybe we should mention that again.
Yeah, she says, these chapters discuss how McLuhan came to develop his own style as a media scholar. They investigate his assertion in the interior landscape that provided the original epiphany that made me see McLuhan in a new light. So this is a sentence that she read in the foreword to The Interior Landscape, came out in 1969, collection of literary criticism from 43 to 62. And I'll read McLuhan's explaining what happened to him at Cambridge. So he says, after a conventional and devoted initiation to poetry as a romantic rebellion against mechanical industry and bureaucratic stupidity, that's what he would have got at the University of Manitoba, all right, the conventional 19th century idea of the poet. Cambridge, which he went to in 1934, Cambridge was a shock. I.A. Richards, F.R. Leavis, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and James Joyce, in a few weeks, opened the doors of perception on the poetic process and its role in adjusting the reader to the contemporary world. Then McLuhan ends the foreword saying, my study of media began and remains rooted in the work of these men. So what's interesting to notice here, the doors of perception were opened onto the poetic process. He said that a few months earlier in the Playboy interview, because this is being written in late 68, early 69, same time he's doing typing up answers to the Playboy interview. He says that Joyce, Eliot, Pound, and Yeats discovered the identity of the creative process. They figured out what creativity was. And he's saying that here. Opened the doors on the poetic process and its role in adjusting the reader to the contemporary world. So, yeah.
So then the next paragraph, she sort of
well, she says immediately after that, she goes, what an amazing sentence that is. And this is the sentence, this little thing we just read was her big epiphany.
Yeah.
Because it supported her idea, oh, what I teach is relevant to media ecology.
Right. So she hijacked it and said, the poetic process, literature, which is her field, the arts, creative thinking, is McLuhan's preferred strategy for adjusting the reader to the contemporary world. And then a few lines later, his complex attempt to read the world in progress. So it's just defining what he's doing, but a little ways along, she says, he called his new research center at the University of Toronto, Center for Culture and Technology. You're still muted, Bob.
She's saying Center for Culture and Technology. She emphasizes
That's what I just said.
No, he didn't read it that way. He just said it monologue.
And unequivocally linking the two cultures, the humanistic and the scientific, into a unique educational project. And we went over that last week, too. I really have to...
But that didn't get recorded.
Oh.
Remember, we did a whole section, this part, that wasn't recorded, and I had to redo it.
Okay.
And you weren't part of that too much. But... here's the point here. When people read McLuhan in the 60s, they had no inkling of what she's saying here. They didn't know that McLuhan was using the poetic process.
No.
He was talking about television and satellites and modern education, modern politics, all these sort of contemporary media-saturated themes or pop culture. Nobody knew where he got it from.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's not... yeah, McLuhan got it from those guys, but how he presented himself was totally original and had nothing to do with the way she states Cambridge influenced McLuhan. Later, McLuhan started to talk about it like this forward, but in the mid-60s, He was just talking about the Frug and the Watusi and the Twists and
Twiggy.
NASA, modern technological phenomena.
Right.
And that's why the popular image around semi-informed intellectuals came up that McLuhan was a technological determinist.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know that McLuhan was in his books a new kind of poet, and that the content was theater, not him, not his roots, the Leavis and Joyce.
Okay.
Only later was he forced to confess that stuff.
And then she goes on to talk about part three, applied.
That was what was important about Thiel's book, the first one he did in 1971. He revealed the very things that Elaine is talking about. He presented that in his book in 1971, and that was a revelation to people. They didn't know McLuhan was, replaying the modernists. Okay, what were you going
to
say?
And then we go to the next paragraph, finally, in part three, the applied McLuhan, and she talks about him cross-reading literature and cinema, and at the bottom of that paragraph, she says, in other words, it is a way to apply McLuhan to the humanities in the attempt to encourage an ecological approach to different fields of studies and communicative genres.
You highlighted that sentence?
Yep. And it sort of reminds me again of Thiel, because that's what I associate him with more than McLuhan, because Thiel went into film and...
he went into content analysis more than McLuhan did.
Oh.
Like McLuhan will just say, Finnegan's Wake is about the electronic awakening of humans.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Don will go into them, pick out passages in Finnegan's Wake, and explain them and exegete them.
Uh-huh.
Don, McLuhan didn't do that. He actually had more important things to say. McLuhan was basically saying, as a technological determinist, that all these modernists that she is trying to make a big deal were dupes of the radio environment. They all were new and were responding to movie and radio and telephones and cars and Joyce television. And the media made their art styles be revolutionary. And so McLuhan said, if we turned off the electric environment, we wouldn't have those artists. And that's a new kind of brainwashing, x-raying, exploring, explaining how culture is determined. Now, this is where the creative process that individual poets came up with and Joyce and them figured out, McLuhan saw the creative process caused sociologically, collectively, through media. He went on a bigger level of the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way of analyzing brainwashing without the judgments, with the anti-MKUltra stuff and anti-CIA. So you have to write a book to, well, our dialogue here might serve to balance off Elena's bias. You know what I mean? This is, her bias is very important to explain this.
Yeah, the media hoiked up these guys, and that's not being discussed.
The media hoiked up, yes, the modernists. And then there's postmodern art, which was caused by the global theater, and McLuhan rides the surf of that. And he looks like a postmodern artist, and he is, but he's more conscious of what's making him a postmodern artist than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're still quoting McLuhan today, and not Tim Leary and these other figures, John Lennon of the 60s, because they didn't have the comprehensive self-awareness or collective complex clairvoyance that McLuhan had about the process that was happening in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Good, good.
And Thiel knew that. But Thiel, he... I used to criticize him for this. He wanted to get back and improve universities because he always was a university professor, a president of a university. At least publicly, that was his career. So he says, you know, you guys need to adapt McLuhan and make our education better. And he thought McLuhan's public image, like Elena said, kind of distracted people. But that's because Don is trying to – he's a bit of a conserving guy. He wants to update university education just like Elena does. That's why these teachers go for Don. McLuhan is more radical. McLuhan is an intellectual anarchist. And that's where McLuhan is a prophet for Ion more than Don Thiel or anybody. But Don Thiel got to have access to it through the Evergreens. Mm. And McLuhan used the evergreens, or right. his family did. So,
so Thiel, I wonder what he'd think today, because universities are totally upside down.
Well, he agreed. He thought that that a website could be a university, and that's what we were doing with Nelson, the McLuhan Institute, and we were going to post Don's PhD and all this different stuff and make our place. It was called ParaMcLuh. The ParaMcLuh.com, and but then Nelson freaked out, went nuts, and we didn't. By early 2003, that project was gone. So it was just me and Don who talk. We continue talking. Nelson's not part of the dialogues anymore, and that goes for another 5 years. And he died a week before we went to Maui.
Oh,
he died around May 14th or so, and we went on the 21st. So I had finished with the East Coast. And Don Thiel, his job had been done in terms of interacting with me.
Okay, so toward the...
But he interacted with me. See, that's right. The great benefit of Thiel. He actually opened-minded enough to take,
engage
with me.
Right. So she sort of ends that on page 17, just with the words, literature matters, I won't go into anything more there. And then over on the other side of page 17, she says, McLuhanese is a language full of potential to achieve a better knowledge of our own actuality. But to appreciate such a language, you need first to be aware of and familiar with its etymology and grammar. So, yeah... I mean, that's what we're talking about here is his etymology and grammar, puns, aphorisms, his pursuit of a progression of effects, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, let me just read that. She says, I am not so arrogant as to compare myself to McLuhan, and after all, I have my own poetics.
Mm-hmm.
That's a feminist angle.
Is kind of an arrogant statement.
Yeah. In brackets, not to mention the fact that at present, not many in the control rooms of power appreciate the potentialities of artistic forms of communication, no matter how amusing or interesting they are. Close bracket. Then she says, McLuhanese is a language full of potential to achieve a better knowledge of our own actuality. But to appreciate such a language, you need first to be aware of and familiar with its etymology and grammar. McLuhan was a grammarian of new environments, which are, on one level, McLuhan, just subplots of words. All media are extensions of words. So words are the primary medium, and that would agree with Ion. And so when you did traditional literate etymology of literate words, that's what people think grammar is. McLuhan was saying, no, we got to do grammar on the new words, television, radio, movies. And that led to the tetrad. So she's using the right words, but for the goal of getting it back to literate words. And then she says, this is what I will be discussing, and McLuhan himself will help me. The thread out of the maze is all his own. Throughout this volume, I will juxtapose quotations from his work, some of his puns and aphorisms, with my own writing in pursuit of a progression of effects. In pursuit of a progression of effects leading to the true substance of McLuhan's mosaic and of his media studies. I would say that she doesn't get to the non-professional, English professional level enough, but Don Thiel does. And Don Thiel is the vestibule from Lamberti to Jessica Pressman's book, Digital Modernism. Now, Lamberti might do it in her later books. You know, she might get more into the media environments and not be so oriented to the Gutenberg legacy.
Are you stopping?
Yeah, so I said, she said, my hope is that my own writing strategy will help to shake off the forgetful snow from a few desks in the control rooms of power. Now, McLuhan went after the control rooms of power. I don't see Elena being able to do that. She hasn't got a unique enough presence to become an iconic figure yet, you know. Now, if she jumps aboard with me, got a chance. But we're doing that. We're the ones taking on
Oh, stop it.
The control rooms of power. What? What do you mean? You worry they're listening?
Well, yeah, I don't want you to go ranting off on sidebars. I want to go on to the next quote.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying my view of it in passing. No, but you have to talk about this. She's saying, she's laying out quite an ambitious thing here. She wants to influence those in power. You're an English professor is not going to influence them. And McLuhan dropped that as he got closer to the control rooms of power after he put out Gutenberg Galaxy. He didn't do any more literary criticism for decades, or, you know, 15 years. He took on the real problems, the real environment. His whole career as a professor was a disguise to get to that position as a modern poet who would legislate the world. You know, Shelley or one of those guys said, the poet is the true legislator of the world. Well, McLuhan wanted to do that. And so he was a serious, the most avant-garde guy compared to Ginsberg, Robert Lowell, Tim Leary, and everybody else. Zappa is the closest to McLuhan, so that's another issue. But McLuhan is the great poet, but none of the poet associations in North America or Europe knew that. They just thought they just carried on writing poetry.
So first of all, you said McLuhan didn't get involved with trying to change or be part of politics, like you're saying Elena wants to influence. So you said in one word or whatever.
I didn't say those words.
McLuhan didn't want to get involved, and then you're saying he wanted to.
Yes. The regular control rooms, and I don't know what Elena thinks of the control rooms, but if she thinks it's politics, she's wrong. The real control power is the CIA and the intelligence agencies. They're the Tetra managers, and that's who Ted Carpenter told me he and McLuhan went after in 1953. They went after the Information Society managers, not the Democratic prime minister or Republican jerk.
Okay.
They had no power. Matter of fact, McLuhan's famous for saying and telling these guys, you're going to have to give up your political platforms and develop an image to keep up with relevance here. Mm-hmm. So he was speaking like a CIA advisor to all parts of society.
Huh. Okay.
But doing it openly.
Gotcha. Okay, page 19, the paragraph starting, among the literary exempla he employed, the most famous is certainly the one I mentioned in my prologue. It derives from Edgar Allan Poe's A Descent into the Maelstrom. So you can just quickly talk about that scene where the vortex is created by them.
The maelstrom.
I wonder, it wouldn't be a tornado.
No, it's some kind of whirlpool in the water.
Whirlpool.
And the sailor and his brother in a boat, and they're going to get sucked down into the storm and the whirlpool. So his brother straps himself to the masthead, thinks that's going to save him somehow. And the writer, the narrator, says, no, I'm not doing that, but what can I do? So he recognizes his pattern eventually that some of the barrels that are sucked down pop back up.
Mm.
Other stuff goes down and doesn't pop up. So he jumped and grabbed onto a barrel that had been going down and popping up, and it continued to go down and pop back up, and that's how he saved himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes a metaphor for McLuhan for the information highway, the information environment that's surrounding everybody, and he calls it a whirlpool, but he spells it W-O-R-L-D, the whirlpool.
Mm-hmm.
So the vortexes and spirals, the broke spirals of informational chaos is what McLuhan begins to offer a solution to for your mind in The Mechanical Bride.
Mm-hmm.
So that's dealing with advertising, magazines, and pop culture, the content. But that didn't work, so then he moved to a broader formal level of looking at the environments themselves, not the content.
And that's exactly page 20. You have to stop eating cheese, Bob.
Well, you got to stop buying it, and you got to stop eating it.
Page 20, hey, Marshall McLuhan, what were you doing? It goes right into exactly what you just said about environment. Inheriting the artist's creative inspiration is a process of subliminally sniffing out environmental change. So the next section
I just want to address that sniffing.
What? Address that sniffing?
Yeah. The point is that McLuhan's going to take on the patterns, the retrievable patterns in the information environment. That's the job of the CIA. That's what intelligence agencies do.
Right.
Now they have the Android meme to do it for them.
Or Facebook.
Yeah, all that media, or digital media. But McLuhan is going to apply Poe not to advertising content. He's going to apply it to the formal dynamic of the interplay in the global theater, the tactile extension of all the media environments in the global theater, and he's going to see what's retrieved, what the patterns are, and he comes up with a tetrad.
Mm.
So that's his barrel of hold on to and see how long it survives. So he's going to do what intelligence agencies are doing, which is tetrad management. The social managers on the intelligence level let people be whatever they want to be. Mm-hmm. They don't have a moralistic society anymore. McLuhan wrote about this in the 50s. He said, we're going from mythic control. He called it mythic. And that was the morality. Society has standards. And so these were imposed on people. And they had to adjust to them. And they had to control their passions. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the middle of the 20th century, McLuhan said the control mechanism moved to norm functioning, that sociological term norm.
Mm-hmm.
And you would let people act out their passions and figure out general patterns from that and control the patterns. But it wasn't a control of imposing a police state. That didn't work before World War II. Now you have friendly fascism. Big Brother goes inside, says McLuhan. He disappears, and you have a James Bond world where the spies and the CIA guys run around putting out fires, and you don't even hear about it. Okay? So then this detachment, the technique of suspended judgment, you're actually not even inventing things anymore. You're letting people go to corporations, get ripped off by corporations, let the people fight among themselves on all levels of innovation. And the real innovation is happening in the daily news. The constant information overload that citizens are scrambling to keep up with. So, because knowing is your only job. All that stuff is the new maelstrom.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan's, and he's presenting this as a consultant to corporations. But for the public, the somnambulist, he writes books in a postmodern style that she's talking about.
And she says, as a whole, a mosaic, or McLuhan's mosaic, creates a pattern in which the assembled components reveal an image which is larger than its parts. So maybe it's like as above, so below. He's got a little mosaic model of the horror of the world. And he's trying to reflect that back to us.
No, that's too much a point of view. He's quadriphenic. He is showing the services of the new global theater and the disservices.
Okay.
And when he jumbles them together in the book, the critics start saying, this guy's contradicting himself all the time.
Yeah.
Now, he purposely is mixing it up like Cantos, Pounds Cantos, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses, and Eliot's Wasteland, and Wyndham Lewis. A lot of Wyndham Lewis techniques in here. So that's the manipulative satire of his books.
And then these so-called literary critics are critical of his puns and aphorisms, often interpreted as verbal tricks used to disguise a lack of precise and coherent point of view. They want a point of view.
Yeah, now, I just thought of something. This digital modernism book by Jessica Pressman, she's trying to show how modernist aesthetics by Joyce and Eliot and those guys and Pound are part of understanding the present media mix. But McLuhan is mixing the modernist roots with the postmodern, forget Joyce and those guys, and direct media management of the economy. So when you read Understanding Media, you see references to high culture stuff like Finnegan's Wake and the Cantos.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the same paragraph or the next paragraph, he's talking like an economist managing media environments, which is too technical for the poetic side.
Mm-hmm.
So his the mixing of the humanistic and scientific, that sometimes happens. But at the other satirical level, McLuhan separates them and makes statements like, Norbert Wiener at MIT are way more important than the literary magazines, the literary claques or cliques.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's actually, there's a part that Lambetti is against, the media guru, the media oracle, the media mask, and the media fan. She says it's unfortunately people get fooled by that image. But that image is complementary to